Brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry, this is the Chemistry World Podcast.
Hello, welcome to February's Chemistry World Podcast. This month, by Phil Broadwith, Nina Notman and Bibiana Campaseo. Coming up, how Egyptian eye makeup, loaded with lead as it was, could have had some hidden beneficial effects. We'll also hear the latest on the bee phenomenon colony collapse disorder, just where do those bees go, and we've a new way to make better biodiesel. It's a clever new catalyst that likes water just as much as it likes oil. Plus, what causes teeth to fall apart and why do fillings often need replacing? Well, scientists now know and they've come up with a way around the problem.
There are proteins under the tooth that will start to destroy the dentine. And these proteins work once the bacteria have removed the inorganic part of the tooth. So the antibacterial agents that we can release will prevent both these proteins from acting to destroy the tooth structure and also the bacteria.
So good news for anyone with an aversion to dentists. And talking of teeth, we have drilled out our Chemistry World conundrum and we've filled the gap with a brand new feature.
Well, Chris, we thought we'd take things up a notch and go with chemical joke of the month. What we want people to do is send in their favourite chemistry jokes. The more terrible, the better, really.
Would you like to get us started?
OK, so here's one to start everybody off. What do you call a tooth in a glass of water?
The answer's on the way, and believe you me, it will set your teeth on edge. Hello, I'm Chris Smith, and this is Chemistry World.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.
First this month to an incredible bit of chemistry and how researchers are making molecules march along. Tell us about this, Phil.
OK, Chris. Well, there's a lot of research at the moment about molecular machines, trying to get molecules to do lots of things that we've seen machines do in them on the macroscopic scale. There's lots of work about trying to get robots to walk, but molecules is even more difficult. What David Lee's team at Edinburgh University are trying to do is work on a molecule that can mimic the actin proteins in our cells, which are little proteins that trundle along tracks, taking various cargoes of protein or whatever to where they need to be in the cell.
So tell us a little bit, first of all, about what the problem is they're trying to solve. So if you had a cell in front of you, for example, we know that cells have microtubules and things that can act as railway tracks for cargoes to go along. Scientists are trying to recreate the trains that pull those cargoes, basically, and that's what these groups are trying to do.
Yes, Chris, that's exactly right. So first, there are two problems here. First of all, you need a track and you need a molecule to walk along the track. Then the second problem is getting the walking molecule to fix itself to the track and move along it at the same time. The third problem is to get it to move along in a specific direction.
And what have they done to try and achieve that?
OK, so the first phase of David Lee's work was to make a molecule that would walk along a track. They took a small track which had four individual footholds and a molecule with two legs. The two feet on the end of the legs are different chemical groups. One is a hydrazide and the other is a sulfide. And on the track, you've then got an aldehyde, which reacts with the hydrazide group to make a hydrazone, and another sulfide, which reacts with the other sulfide on the walker to make a disulfide bridge.
So you've got a right foot and a left foot, and the right foot goes in the right foothold, and the left foot in the left foothold. So it's already a polarised system.
Yeah, that's exactly right, Chris. What they did in the first phase was to cycle the conditions between acidic and basic. When you're under acid conditions, the hydrazone foot will detach itself, so you're stuck on by the disulfide foot, and the hydrazone foot can move about and it can go to either of the two aldehyde footholds. And that's an equilibrium process, and you get a random selection of things. Then you cycle the conditions through to basic, and the hydrazone foot is stuck, and the disulfide foot can switch between its two footholds in equilibrium.
So that's your step forward. The problem is, what stops it going backwards as well as forwards?
Exactly. The problem there is we've got a completely random, thermodynamically driven equilibrium process. So what they then did is to introduce a bias on one of those feet. Disulfides can not only be broken and made in base, they're also susceptible to oxidation. So instead of using a base, if you then reduce the disulfide, you lift off the disulfide foot. Then if you add an oxidant, you reattach the foot. But that's an irreversible process. So you lock the foot in position straight away. And that is enough to give you a slight bias towards moving in one direction rather than the other.
It's a whole new spin on Take a Walk on the Wild Side, doesn't it? Thank you, Phil. Now, Nina, let's move back from the present to several thousand, probably about 5,000 years back in time, to ancient Egypt. Fascinating study on that very gaudy, gothic, for want of a better term, eye makeup that many ancient Egyptians used to wear. What's it all about?
That's right. So it's written in ancient Egyptian literature that eye makeup was an essential remedy for treating eye infections and skin ailments, but there's not been any recent studies into why this might be.
So it's in the writing, but no proof, basically, scientifically, till now, presumably.
Until now. So Philip Walters' group have been looking at what the makeup actually consists of. So they've been looking at ancient recipes and partly using samples of makeup that was found in tombs. And using scanning electron microscopy and quantitative X-ray diffraction, they've been looking at the samples from the tomb, and they've found that there's a number of lead compounds in there.
But lead's awfully bad for you, isn't it?
It turns out it might not be if you put it on your skin. So they've found in the makeup there's four different lead compounds, lead sulfide, which gives them the glossy black colour, and three other white lead compounds. Now, a couple of these white compounds are not naturally available, so they were synthesising them. They must have been doing that for a reason. So this is where the second group come in. So Christian Amatoire's group have been proposing that because lead is quite similar to calcium in its charge and radius, etc., and calcium is known to trigger the body's immune defences through enzymatic systems, maybe lead was doing the same thing. And they've been using electrochemistry to study this and looking at the biochemical interaction between lead and cells. And they have indeed found that when skin is exposed to the lead 2+ ion, it gives off nitric oxide. Now, nitric oxide is a molecule known to stimulate immune defences, so therefore it seems that the Egyptians did have a reason for doing this.
Pretty wild, though, to think you put eye makeup on to make yourself better from bacterial and other potential infections. But was it therefore that the women wore the eye makeup and were healthier than the men, or was this very unisex?
I'm no historian, so I don't know. But if you take a look on the Chemistry World website, you'll see a suspiciously cross-dressing-looking Egyptian.
One to keep an eye on, I think. Thank you, Nina. Now, where are all the bees going? Mike Edwards.
There have been a lot of stories about collapse of bee colonies and how pollination is going to be affected disastrously, partly coming out of a story from the United States where the almond orchards, and that produces well over half the world's almonds, are reliant on honeybees, which are moved from one end of the United States to the other to pollinate the crop. The collapse, as far as they are concerned, has been very real, but it is not necessarily a collapse of all bees. It is to do with one managed pollinator.
And when people say colony collapse, is that a bit of an over-exaggeration, or do you literally see a bee colony that's been previously fit and well just vanishing?
Absolutely. This is what's so odd about it. The workers don't seem to ever come back to the hive. They just die off outside. Now, actually, we know that's what happens with an awful lot of bees. To digress slightly from honeybees, bumblebees are affected by a fly which jumps on their back and inserts its egg into its abdomen. Now, the bumblebee, once it's got an egg in its abdomen, its response is actually to stay away from the colony. It's not a hive in terms of managed hives with frames or anything else, but it's still a colony of insects. And it stays away, the object being, if it can make the fly larva cold, the fly larva can't grow fast enough. The bee can still work and take its pollen back into the hive, but it spends the night out in the cold. So there's a fight going on. And there's probably something like that when the honeybees don't feel up to it. They don't go back in the hive, because if you go back in, you take whatever you've got with you.
It sounds to me like you're suspecting not so much a chemical culprit, but a parasitic or perhaps some other kind of infestationary type manifestation going on here.
Most definitely. There's lots and lots of work done trying to tie it down to chemicals. The overall feeling in honeybee hives is there are more chemicals in the hive which are due to treatments for varroa, particularly another parasitic mite, than the bees are bringing in from the countryside.
Because people have tried to tie various chemical usages to infestations to manifestations of colony collapse disorder in various countries. Sometimes they tie up, sometimes they don't. In some cases, compensation has been paid, which argues that perhaps manufacturers of chemicals do acknowledge that they could be having at least a part to play in this.
They're all stresses. We get our food because we persuade or tell the vast number of insects out there not to live on this plant. We actually make sure they can't. And in that way, honeybees are no different, and no other bee is any different. It visits plants because it wants something from the plant. There's rather a sort of soft feeling about pollination. Well, actually, the bees are robbing the plant, and the plant's trying to make the robbery to its best advantage.
Some people have said, though, if you look at the practices that go on in the US, because you brought up the question of the almond trees in California, hundreds of miles of them, isn't it? It's really quite striking. Mass agriculture. The way in which those trees get pollinated is because farmers drive bees, billions of bees, many, many miles, dump them near these trees at the right time of year, get them working like dervishes to pollinate all the trees, and then they steal all of the honey the bees have made and feed the bees back some fairly weak sugar solution to make up for it. And some people have suggested this is leading to a progressive and evolving lack of fitness amongst the bees.
Yes, you know about rickets in humans, which is a vitamin deficiency. Exactly the same if you just put sucrose in, then you're not putting any of the micronutrients which the bees collect from the plants, and that includes pollen as well. But as well, if I force you to live on something you could theoretically live on, let's say bran flour, you aren't going to be very fit either. Now, this is something which intrigues me with beekeepers and pollination. Some of these flowers are not very attractive to honeybees. They don't actually want to go to them. And the answer's been to remove all the wildflowers, all the other stuff that might distract them. So they've got to go. But that in itself produces stresses on the managed bees.
Would you say that the situation we're seeing at the moment with the bee could be a sort of bee-perfect storm, where we've had ill treatment of bees, for want of a better phrase, for a while, which has led to an evolved and perhaps inbred weakness? They're also not very well able to defend themselves because we keep robbing them of the micronutrients in their honey. This has perhaps culminated in surges in infestations with parasites of some sort. This all comes together and is contributing to this phenomenon, colony collapse disorder. But if you go looking for a single cause, you're not going to find it.
I think that's a fairly good summary. It's a bit of everything, and depending where you are. The point is that colony collapse disorder, it gets labelled to anything that happens unexpected.
What do you think we should do? How should we approach the problem and solve it?
In the UK, it's much easier than it is in the States because we don't have these huge movements to single flower floral restriction, you know, just go and visit royalty rape and do nothing else. But we do have a loss of floral diversity in the countryside. Now, I'm a little bit unhappy about paying government money spent for conservation, providing forage just for honeybees, which are really a managed pollinator. They're a cow. However, it's quite good because if you make good flowery margins in the fields, then the chances are that all many other bees will visit those as well, provided you make the flowers the sort of things which our native bees and their 250 species want to visit. We've done some work on that with Syngenta, and the result, certainly for bumblebees, where we've targeted this, has been extremely good. We've had consistent year-on-year increases in numbers of bees on forestry treatment, and that seems to translate to increases in population. Providing a better diet is a good idea throughout the countryside. Providing that and sticking a bee honeybee colony on it, I think, negates the conservation argument completely, because you're swinging it completely so that the honeybees get the best value out of it. But I'm quite happy to have honeybees visit as part of a whole spectrum of pollinators.
Mike Edwards on what we think underlies BCCD, colony collapse disorder. Mike's an independent ecological consultant, and he specialises in entomology. This is Chemistry World with me, Chris Smith. Still to come, a new catalyst to beef up biodiesel production, how fish larvae are helping scientists to find superior antidepressants, and new fillings for teeth that won't fall out, hopefully. But first, Bibi, the element copper, seems to be coming to the rescue in the field of carbon capture. Tell us more.
Yes, the team of researchers at Leiden University have developed a selective copper complex that can trap carbon dioxide selectively from atmospheric gases. Basically, the complex is simple in that it has two binding sites, and each of the binding sites has a copper atom with an oxidation state 1, and they make it into a solution, bubble carbon dioxide through the solution, and the two oxygen atoms of the carbon dioxide molecule bind to each of the copper atoms.
So the CO2 goes into the solution, interacts with the copper in the 1+ state, it locks onto the oxygen. Then what happens to the carbon?
Then the carbon atoms of two of the molecules bind together, creating an oxalate bridge that binds two halves, if you like, of the molecule. So we end up having a tetranuclear system that contains four molecules of carbon dioxide as oxalate bridges between the two halves of the molecule.
Oh, wow, so they've actually got the carbons bonding together.
Yes.
So how do you then get that molecule off of the copper again?
Well, they use lithium salts to extract the oxalate, which then can be used for making oxalic acid, for example, which is used in household cleaning products, or methane or formaldehyde. And once they have removed the carbon dioxide, which was present as an oxalate, then they need to return the copper from an oxidation state 2 to an oxidation state 1, and they do that by electrochemical reduction. They have to apply a very small voltage of minus 0.03 relative to the normal hydrogen electrode.
Oh, so you just pass a small current through the solution, it all resets itself and you can start again?
Yes, and they have proved that it is reusable. They did, over a course of 7 hours, 6 rounds of carbon dioxide removal, and it worked very well. The only thing to take into consideration is that you can get a build-up of lithium oxalate over the electrodes, but that's something that can be solved pretty easily.
So they think this is energetically and also economically viable, and it's also scalable, so you could wire this up to a big source of CO2, not just a test tube in a lab.
Yes, they're looking to hopefully develop some industrial applications. But at the moment, they're quite far away from that.
Still very exciting, though. Thank you, Bibi. Now, Nina, sticking with sort of similar theme, lots of people are very interested in the idea of biomass and producing bioethanol from biomass and therefore producing a more environmentally friendly fuel. Been difficult to do it effectively and efficiently, but you might have some answers.
Yes, in the form of a new catalyst that works at the oil-water interface, and it can be easily removed from a solution. So as you just mentioned, the biomass which we get from farming or domestic waste or from the paper industry, once you heat it, you get bio-oil, but this needs to be refined to be useful. And by refined, we mean it needs to be deoxygenated, and also all the molecules within it need to be roughly the same size. So this new catalyst is a combination of metal nanoparticles and carbon nanotubes. One of the problems with the bio-oil is the fact that the oil actually tends to be an emulsion of water and oil, with the water containing the smaller molecules and the oil containing the longer molecules.
And you obviously want to get it efficient, all the small stuff to turn into big stuff in the oil, which
Indeed
is the trick.
You do. And that's what this catalyst can do. So the catalyst itself has a hydrophobic area, the carbon nanotube, and a hydrophilic area, the metal oxide nanoparticles. When the catalyst is put into solution of bio-oil, it sits itself within the interface. And on the water side, the magnesium oxide nanoparticles causes the molecules to polymerise, to become longer molecules. And once they become a certain length, they then all switch over to the oil side. And on the oil side, where you've got the carbon nanotube, there's also some palladium nanoparticles embedded within these. And it's the palladium nanoparticles that do the deoxygenation process of the longer molecules. So eventually you end up with all of the molecules that you want within the oil phase. So then you can separate out your water, and you can also sieve out your catalyst because it's a solid phase catalyst.
Is this, again, scalable? Can we get this up to a level where you could produce appreciable amounts of fuel via this route?
I think there's some tweaking that needs to be done, but that's certainly what the researchers are aiming for.
So something of a yin-yang catalyst that likes both oil and water. Thank you, Nina. Now, here's something to get your teeth into. Better fillings. Anne Young.
What we're interested in are adhesive methacrylates to repair tooth and bone, materials that can go from liquid to solid with just a few seconds of exposure to blue light.
Playing devil's advocate for a minute, though, Anne, we've had the ability to fill teeth for a very long time. So what's the problem with that?
The major problem is bacteria getting down underneath the tooth restoration. What you get when the material sets in the tooth is you get microgaps, and bacteria penetrate down between these microgaps and cause reinfection.
Why do you get these microgaps? What's actually happening chemically to open up these spaces?
The materials are methacrylates, and when they go from liquid to solid, the chemical reaction causes a small shrinkage. We can do things to try and reduce that shrinkage by adding in lots of inorganic filler particles, but you always still have these micro gaps. You also tend to generate them with time. When you're eating or chewing, you put forces onto the restoration. When you eat hot or cold things, the material shrinks or expands to a different extent to the surrounding tooth. So you get these cracks developing, and then you get your bacteria going down underneath the restoration.
So that pretty much means that almost any tooth filling we have is destined to fail eventually.
It's the major cause of tooth restoration, certainly with the white composite materials, because they're not antibacterial. They have no way of preventing the growth of bacteria underneath the tooth.
Presumably there's a way around that then.
The way we're looking at is to release antibacterial agents. These not only kill the bacteria that are underneath the tooth, but they can also prevent the tooth starting to degrade itself. There are proteins in under the tooth that will start to destroy the collagen of the dentine. And these proteins work once the bacteria have removed the inorganic part of the tooth. So the antibacterial agents that we can release will prevent both these proteins from acting to destroy the tooth structure and also the bacteria.
So that's clever. You're talking about putting the chemicals that will protect the tooth into the filler or repair material itself so that the thing doesn't just fill the gap, it also protects the tooth into the long term.
Yes, we're also releasing other calcium phosphate components that can help remineralize the tooth. If the tooth has lost its calcium and phosphate species, we release low levels of these from the tooth restoration material, and that can also help to close up those gaps that form with time.
Could you take it a step further and try to get teeth to actually repair themselves? Because you mentioned that you can get the tooth tissue coming back into the restoration. Could you come up with some way of making a material that either had cells in it that were capable of slowly eroding away the restoration material and replacing it with native tooth material, or some kind of restoration material that would encourage cells to come out of the healthy tooth tissue and form a tight interface with the restoration and then slowly eat it away to replace it with tooth again?
That's difficult to do with tooth because of the limited number of cells. We actually can do that with bone. Bone itself will actually regrow if you give it space to do so. One thing we're doing is we're modifying these materials so that they are degradable. They will stick the bone together to start with, but then degrade slowly because of the action of the cells. We can then have the cells use calcium phosphate components we have within the materials to help regenerate the bone that's been damaged by disease.
So are you still at the stage where you're just putting effectively glue with a few chemical tweaks into teeth, or is there the potential to put bigger stuff, whole cells or maybe even big molecules, DNA, nucleic acids, that kind of thing in there that might have therapeutic potential?
We can do that with some of the new materials we're developing that are degradable. We can put DNA inside nanoparticles that can target cells. The cells will make the degradable adhesive degrade with time and release the DNA within these nanoparticles, and then we can get slow transfection of cells in surrounding the adhesive.
And what sorts of jobs would that DNA do?
At the moment, biologists are developing a number of methods of identifying genetic problems, that parts of the gene that are wrong. So if we can put the part of the gene that's wrong into the cells, we can cure a wide range of different diseases. The problem at the moment is we use viruses to transfect cells, but there are a lot of toxicological concerns with the use of viruses. Potentially the sort of materials we're developing will be a lot safer.
Is this still a laboratory-confined project, or have you now got this out into a clinical environment where you can demonstrate in patients that there is the potential for this to work?
We have a dental company that's potentially interested, and we've got funding from another small startup company that is looking to use the materials for bone repair. We're looking to try and get to clinical trials within about a year.
Anne Young, who's a chemist based at the Eastman Dental Institute in London. In just a second, how fish larvae are helping scientists to categorise new drugs. But first, Phil, click this next story into place for us, if you would.
Yes, Chris. Well, what we're talking about here is something called bioconjugation, which is attaching small molecules to the surface of proteins. You can either have a fluorescent tag to track the proteins, as you say, or you can attach other interesting molecules to see how they interact with the protein. This has been done before by various means, but most of those involve attaching to either lysine or cysteine residues on the protein.
Which is nice, as long as you've got those conveniently handy in your protein to stick something onto, presumably.
Well, yes, and the problem with cysteine in particular is that it generally tends to be embedded in the middle of the protein and involved in disulfide bridges, so it's not particularly accessible unless you provide a mutation that puts one on the surface.
And then, of course, you worry about, have you distorted the structure of the protein?
Exactly, and the problem with lysine, on the other hand, is that there are far too many of them. So lysine's very abundant on the surface of proteins, so getting your molecule onto one in particular and having it in the right place isn't very easy.
So what do you think is the solution, or what have scientists come up with as an alternative?
OK, well, Carlos Barbas at the Scripps Research Institute in La Jolla in California has come up with a new reaction that modifies tyrosine residues.
So a totally different chemical approach. Are they as abundant as lysine and as inaccessible as cysteine, though? I mean, how does this improve things?
OK, well, tyrosine does tend to be on the surface of proteins, and there generally tend to be fewer of them than lysine, so you've got a little bit more selectivity.
So what do they do to the tyrosine to enable them to use it as a convenient way to link things onto the protein?
The molecule that the group have come up with is a cyclic diazocarboxamide. It has a very reactive nitrogen-nitrogen double bond in a small ring, and that attaches itself next to the alcohol on the phenyl group on the tyrosine.
Would the plan then be that you would use that molecule conjugated to whatever you wanted to stick onto the protein, and then you would basically incubate the two together and they would form some kind of bond?
Yes, that's exactly right. So the group have shown that they can have various other gubbins fixed to the back of this cyclic diazocarboxamide molecule, and it will still attach itself onto various short peptides or proteins. The big challenge with this kind of chemistry is getting it to work efficiently enough and under mild enough conditions. If you're not under more or less neutral aqueous conditions, then the protein can suffer damage.
Also, the benefit of things like GFP, green fluorescent protein, is that you can get the cell to make it itself, and therefore the proteins that the cells make are then automatically being tagged. So wouldn't this stuff be really toxic to a cell, and therefore would that not limit its use?
I think maybe we're looking more at isolated proteins rather than actually in cells and as they're made. And I mean, the other advantage is that you can take proteins and attach all sorts of things like to them, like different kinds of sugars. So you can start mimicking post-translational modification. You can see what happens if we stick six or seven different kinds of sugar over the surface of this protein, as it might be done in the natural course, but you can do it in a controlled way.
Thank you, Phil. And also, Bibi, sticking with things that are really, really small, but not quite as small as these molecules, this is zebrafish larvae, embryos, terrific things to see under the microscope because you can use them to study various things.
Yeah, once more, zebrafish comes to the rescue. One of the main problems when trying to develop psychoactive drugs is that it's very difficult to predict how small molecules will be altering complex behaviours. So this team of researchers at Harvard University, led by Alexander Shear, have developed a novel screening method that utilises zebrafish to monitor their response to thousands of different small molecules.
May seem like a rather basic question, but obviously a zebrafish is not a human, and psychoactive drugs change behaviour. So how can we use a fish embryo as a model for what would happen in a person?
Well, It's a very interesting question. What they want to do is they want to use it as a high throughput technique that then allows them to create a behavioral fingerprint or barcode, which then allows them to cluster or classify the drugs depending on the response of the fish to that particular drug.
And what sorts of responses are they measuring in the fish in order to work out what the drugs are doing?
They have pipetted a single zebrafish larva into each of the wells of a 96-well plate, and to add, they have added the potential drug. And then they monitor what happens after that using different using computer software. They look at the larvae for 3 days and they analyze the sleeping and waking patterns. They look at the levels of activity, the number and duration of the rest bouts. So basically, they look at what the larvae do for 3 days.
And this informs what sorts of behavioural changes the drugs might have in a bigger animal and then taken forward for analysis or appraisal in other animal models, more expensive animal models, including humans, presumably.
Yes, absolutely. At the moment, this is thought to be a method that can be used in combination with cell culture studies or rodent studies so that large groups of drugs can be characterized and clustered very rapidly. But of course, then you have to do the proper studies after that to see what how this will work in people. In about 2 years, they have done 4,000 unique structures and they have recorded the behavioral profiles of more than 60,000 larvae. So they have gathered a lot of information that then will be very useful for the design of these psychoactive drugs.
So psychoactive drug classification by zebrafish. In fact, I'm told the animals end up thinking that they're tigers after the experiment's over. Only joking. Thank you, Bibi. Well, that's pretty much it for this month. But before we go, we had better catch up with the answer to the chemical conundrum from last time. So, Phil, please do remind us of the question.
Well, yes. Last month, what we asked you was, what chemical compound is used in car engine coolant systems and windscreen washing fluids to prevent it from freezing in cold weather?
And the answer is ethylene glycol, which actually lowers the freezing point of water. The winner is Imogen Brignot from County Wicklow in Ireland.
So well done to her. Now, for next month, you're going to have a bit of a change of tack. So the chemical conundrum is going on the back burner for a bit, the back Bunsen burner, possibly even. What have you got in mind for next month and on?
Well, Chris, we thought we'd take things up a notch and go with chemical joke of the month. Well, what we want people to do is send in their favourite chemistry jokes. The more terrible, the better, really.
So basically, you tell a crap joke, and the worse it is, the more likely you are to win.
Well, the funnier, But different people find different things funny, so we'll just have to judge it on.
And you'll pick one each month.
Yeah, so every month we'll pick what we think is the best joke, and that person will get the Chemistry World goodie bag.
Would you like to get us started?
OK, so here's one to start everybody off. What do you call a tooth in a glass of water?
I don't know. What do you call a tooth in a glass of water?
Well, it's a one molar solution.
That is terrible. OK, so jokes of that kind of rubbish ilk are welcome here at the Chemistry World podcast.
Well, I'm sure that the listeners out there can do a lot better, so we'll see what comes in.
So if you have an affinity, to coin a chemical phrase, for cringe-inducing, chemically relevant gags, then please do send them in. The email address, chemistryworld@rsc.org, and you can, of course, also use that address to send us any comments, thoughts or feedback about this programme. That's it for this episode, but do bear in mind that before we return next month, you can keep yourself entertained, at least chemically speaking, by tuning in to our sister podcast called Chemistry in Its Element, where each week we take a look at the sinister side of the elements that make up the periodic table. That's available on iTunes and also from the Chemistry World website at chemistryworld.org/elements. The contributors this month were Phil Broadwith, Nina Notman and Bibiana Campos-Sejo. The production was by Mira Senthilingam, and I'm Chris Smith from thenakedscientist.com. See you next time.
The Chemistry World podcast is brought to you by the Royal Society of Chemistry. Look us up online at chemistryworld.org.